So swing the bus. Okay, so right now we have a very interesting session, and this is on emerging developments in medical and other technologies such as stem cells, cyborgs, and artificial intelligence. The theme for this session is, are you ready for the future? And Ajahn's Bhante Sujato has pointed out that, if you notice, there isn't a single woman on this panel, and therefore the future seems to imply that in the hands of the men. So I'm just the token woman up here to introduce these wonderful, amazing, strange speakers, which include Ajahn Bhante Sujato himself. Bhante Sujato was known as Mr. Best at one time, and is an Australian Buddhist monk who used to be a musician, if you're not aware, and former Catholic before he traveled to Thailand in search of a new direction and entered an extensive Vipassana retreat in Chiang Mai. And he has spent many years in Bodhiana, and also at one point he was the abbot of the Santi Monastery, which he has since retired from and given way to a nun's monastery to be formed and now headed by Venerable Niroda. So, so it gives me great pleasure to introduce to you, to kick off the session on making sense of this afternoon panel and what they're going to be talking about. Please join me to welcome Bhante Sujato.
Okay, hi everyone. I'm Bhante Sujato. So when I told people that we're doing a panel which was like cyborgs and robots and artificial intelligence and stuff, and they said, what's that got to do with Buddhism? I'm like, who cares? I will find some. We'll find some kind of Buddhist angle on there, you know. I mean, you know, speaking as a sort of long-time sci-fi geek and things like that, you know, if you're familiar with the story of the Buddha's life, you know that when the Buddha was a child, when he was a young boy, he had a transcendent experience where he was sitting under the tree and he just spontaneously went into deep meditation. And that changed his life, that experience that he had as a young boy. Well, when I was a young boy, I also had a transcendent religious experience. Right? Sitting in the dark, I remember the year, 1977, sitting in the dark, and then the words appear in front of you, a long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. And there is, technically in the past, but a future, you know, lightsabers, faster than light travel, flying cars, all of those kinds of things. And the coolest people in the whole universe, right, are basically the Buddhist monks who are living in the jungles and the deserts doing all of these intensive mindfulness exercises, right? That's what the Jedi Knights are, yeah? So these days you can say you'll be a Jedi Knight just in the census, right? You can identify your religion as being Jedi, which I think is a bit unfair because it's really just a subsect of Buddhism anyway. So this is like a possible future, and there's like this sense of wonder that we can have at that, right? And I mean, I was at that perfect age where you can see that, and you're like, what could this be? What might happen in the future? But of course, that's not the only possible future. I remember another movie which I saw, which also led a very impression that I remember to this day. It's not about flying cars and lightsabers, but it's about a man driving a car across a desert, Mad Max. And I know there's been a new Mad Max movie. As a monk, I'm not allowed to go to the cinema, but I hear that it's very good. Has anyone seen the new Mad Max movie? Yeah, is it good? Yeah, okay, very good. Did it make you feel very peaceful afterwards? But this is like another possible future, isn't it, right? I mean, you look at that and you think, well, this is not by no means inconceivable, right? This is something which it could be a terrifying vision of what our future may well be. And I was joking about this the other day, and I was saying, you know, you can see that a film is a parable for the future. If you're a member of our current government, you'd probably look at it and think, huh, policy outcomes. So what kind of future are we going to create? Are we going to we have our technology with which we can do all of these incredible things. You know, we can fly. Just last week we had these incredible images from Pluto, right? And an incredible thing, almost every day we're getting these unbelievable technological achievements. I've even heard that there is, in the very near future, that we'll actually be able to get PowerPoint presentations to work properly. But don't hold your breath, it's like a cure for cancer. They've been promising that for years. Anyway, so we are creating this future. It's a future that we are building all of the time. So one of the things that the Buddha taught us is that we're creating the future. There's nothing is fixed. There's no such idea as destiny in Buddhism. It's all about our acts. And the Buddha always talked about, he used this one word, Dhamma, which we're very familiar with. And the word Dhamma is one of the most radical teachings that the Buddha gave. The word Dhamma, as you probably most of you know, means something like a nature or phenomena or natural phenomena or natural law. And he also, the Buddha used the word Sankhara a lot. Sankhara often having a meaning of something like an energy or some kind of conditioned or energetic patterns that create and condition the world that we're going to live in. And so the world as depicted by the Buddha was a world which was not created by some outside force. It wasn't created by a god or anything like that. It's not sustained by any kind of metaphysical substance like a soul or a self or anything like that. But it's a world which is bootstrapped. Right? It's networked, where things lean up against each other. Things condition each other and cause each other. And so everything that we look at from a Buddhist world, whether in the internal sphere in our own meditation or in the external sphere in the ecology and the society and all of these kinds of things, whether on the largest scale of universes and cosmology or on the most tiny scale of quarks and so on, and all of this, what we're seeing is we're seeing energies, we're seeing patterns, we're seeing change, we're seeing transformation. And so these are the things which the Buddha called the Dhammas and the Sankharas, all of these things which are part of that world. And so we are not actors upon that world. We are participants in that world. We are part of it. And so that future that we're going to create, are we going to have a future where so many of the promises of technology in terms of medical advances and so on, where these are going to be realized and we can live in a future where people are free from hunger and so on? Technologically, I think these things are possible. I don't think the technological problems are solvable. But the real problem is that human problem. What choices are we going to make? Okay, and we live in a world which is so incomprehensibly strange, okay, that people say we are headed towards apocalypse of one form or another, right? From climate change, perhaps from biological forms or nuclear forms or whatever it might be. And people talk about things like turning the ocean into algae, or putting like armies of nanobots in space to reflect the sun and to cool down our planet. These things are thinkable, right? These things are part of a public dialogue. But the thought that we could be saying, perhaps we could buy less stuff, that's not thinkable. Yeah? That's not part of our public sphere, our public dialogue. But I think it has to become that way. And we have to, you know, our culture in the future, if we want to have a future, that culture in the future, we have to be asking ourselves these questions: can I be happy without more stuff? If I'm going to live in a world where my children have less stuff than I did, can we be happy to live in that kind of world? And of course the Buddhist answer is yes. The Buddhist answer is you don't need much stuff. a little bit is enough. And if we are content to have a little bit, and if we don't always have to have everything all the time, then we can together create a world that's worth living in. And we can create a world where the wonders of technology, the marvels that technology opens, we can see the fruits of that, and we can see the benefits of that. And we can see the movement where an increased understanding of consciousness, of intelligence, of awareness, of perception, all these kinds of things in the scientific realm can move towards and be informed by our inner understanding through meditation. That convergence, I think, is the most exciting thing that's happening in our world today. One of the most exciting changes that's happening ever in history. Can we bring together and unite those two technologies, the external scientific rational technology of Western science and the inner methodology and technology of meditation from Buddhism and the Eastern religions? If we can do that, that's a remarkable thing, and it's a future which I'd like to live in. So thanks very much.
Thank you for setting the scene, Bhante Sujata. So our first, well, not the first, the second speaker, is a rather unusual person. He's a cyborg. And I think you can see him seated there in his blue jacket and an antenna coming out of his brain. He's 33-year-old, a Catalan contemporary artist, composer and cyborg activist. Best known for his ability to hear colors and to perceive colors outside the ability of human vision. And as we were passing by just now, he mentioned that he is connected to the internet so he can hear the sounds of colors, not just within this room, but even the outside world. So in 2003, he took part in the development of the iBorg, a cybernetic eye permanently attached to his head that allows him to hear the frequencies of colors through bone conduction. Harbison started to feel like the cyborg, which is a union between his organism and cybernetics, when he started to hear colors in his dreams. And since then, he creates sonochromatic artworks and performances that explore the relationship between color and sound and the relationship between bodies and cybernetics. In 2010, he co-founded the Cyborg Foundation with Moon Ribas, an international organization that aims to help people become cyborgs. So any one of you interested, please let him know. So he believes that this new antenna opens up new communication possibilities that go beyond our traditional sensors. So maybe he can explain whether this will also help us to gain enlightenment. So please welcome Neil Harbison.
Well, yes, I was born completely colorblind, so I've never seen blue, orange, yellow. I don't know what color looks visually, but even if I couldn't see color, I couldn't ignore that color exists, because everyone that surrounded me kept using color words, so I couldn't ignore the existence of color, because there's many elements that surround us, like yellow pages, blue tack, Bluetooth, the green card, James Brown is in his surname. So many daily elements that contain the word of color, and that reminded me every single day of my life that color existed, but that I couldn't sense it. The Red Cross, Red Bull, red wine, Greenland, a huge country as well, containing the word of a color. Also, when you use color as a code, it can be confusing. Hot water and cold water, or in maps, this is fine, but if I go to Tokyo, I can get easily lost, because some maps only use color codes. Also, to me, three countries share the same flag. And also, if someone asked me, have you seen a man with ginger hair, blue eyes, and dressed in pink? I would have no idea, because the only information I get here is that the man has hair, that he has eyes, and that he's not naked. So, the reason why I wanted to sense color was not because I thought that color was beautiful, but because it was a social element, and I felt there was a social wall between me and others. So, I decided to find a way of extending my senses and perceive color, and then I realized that Newton created a scale relating colors with sounds, and after Newton, there were many other people that related color with sound. So I was interested in this relationship, because there is a relationship between both, because they're both frequencies. Sound is an audible frequency and color is a light frequency. So the aim was to create create a third eye that would allow me to sense the sound of color. So in 2003, I started this project where it was basically a webcam connected to a 5-kilo computer and a pair of headphones, and then the software in the computer was picking up the light frequencies in front of me and transposing it to sound. So I was able to hear the different sounds of color, like red is the lowest visually, so it sounded S, the lowest, and then it went up, as you can hear, very microtonally. Yeah. So it's very subtle changes, because there's very subtle changes in hue, so it's very, very, very microtonal. So at the beginning, life was chaotic, because everywhere I looked, I could hear sounds. It became very annoying at the beginning, but then it became normal. This chaos became a sense. It became subliminal. I didn't have to think F is red, C sharp is blue. It just became automatic. So I started feeling favorite colors as well through sound. Then I had different volume levels depending on saturation. So if the color is very vivid, it's louder than if it's a grayish color. And then there was a point when I was able to perceive all visual colors. After 3 years, in 2007, I could distinguish all visual colors through sound. And I didn't see why I should stop there, because there's many more colors that humans could not see, like ultraviolet and infrared. So I included these two colors in 2008, and this allowed me now to perceive more colors than the visual ones. And this is quite useful, because ultraviolet allows me to feel if it's a good day or a bad day to sunbathe, because if I hear ultraviolet, then I know it's not a very good moment to sunbathe, because ultraviolet can damage your skin. And infrared allows me to know if the alarms are on or off in shops or in banks. And it's quite interesting to see that in many cases, alarms are off. So the aim after this was to create a body part, because I didn't want to use technology and I didn't want to wear technology. I wanted to become technology because it felt more practical. So the first idea was to create a third eye in the middle of the head, so it would go implanted here and I would have it permanently in my face. But then I realized that this would limit my vision to only what I would have in front of me. So I looked at nature and I realized that many animals and insects have antennas that allow them to actually sense around them without separating vision from other senses. So I wanted to have an independent sense of color that would disconnect from sight and from hearing. So the aim was to sense color through the antenna and not hear it through my ears, but through my bones, because bone can conduct sound. So the idea was to drill an antenna inside my skull, and then through the vibrations in my bone, I would hear the sound of color. So I presented an antenna implant to a doctor, and he said, sorry, we don't do this here. We don't do antenna implants. You have to find someone else. So first he said, you have to convince a bioethical committee. If they say yes, then you can do it. The committee said, no, this is not ethical, because it goes beyond vision, because it's not... It wouldn't look good to the hospital if someone came in and came out with an antenna. They were worried about this. So in the end, I found a doctor that did it anonymously, and then we did the surgery. It took 4 hours, and it was actually four implants, because before the surgery, we said, now that we're going to drill your head, why don't you also add internet connection so you can receive colors from other parts of the world? So we included Bluetooth that allows me to connect to mobile phones. So if someone sends videos to my phone, these colors can go directly to my head and then I can sense the colors. This also allows me to connect to satellites so I can perceive the colors from space. So it's now more of a sensory extension that allows me to sense color beyond what is around me. Now, the union between the antenna and my bone took a couple of months, so the physical union, so now the antenna is merged with my bone, so if someone pulls the antenna, it's not possible to be removed, even if you pull hard, because it's inside the bone, and that took 2 months, more or less. I had to get used also to the new height, because now I'm 7 centimeters taller, officially, so it's another thing. And then the union that I feel is the strongest is the invisible union, the union between the software and my brain. When I started to hear colors in my dreams was when the brain started to create sound of color, not the software. So that's when I felt cyborg, the union between cybernetics and organism. So when I dream, if there's a sky or there's oranges, I hear the sound of C sharp. If there's a sky, or I hear the sound of oranges. So this is when I started to feel no separation between software and brain. And this is something I had to also explain to the passport office in 2004, because I sent a picture of my face with the antenna, and they say, no, you can't appear on passport photos with electronic equipment. So they asked me to remove the antenna from the image, and I said, that's not possible. It's a new body part, an extension of my senses. It should be allowed. And said, no, remove the antenna. And then I kept insisting. In the end, they said yes, so it allowed me in the first passport to appear with the first antenna. This helps a lot in... It helps a lot security controls, because airport people, they really don't like technology. So if you are technology, they actually hate you. So it helps to have some proof that it's officially part of my image. My life has changed in many ways. Before, I would dress in a way that it would look good, but now I dress in a way that it sounds look good. So I choose the different colors that I want to wear, which are different notes. So I can actually dress in C major, for example, which would be this combination. So that would be a happy... chord, whereas this is more of a minor chord. I would dress like this in a funeral, for example. And then you can also wear a song. So you can design specific clothes that sounds like a song. This is electronic music transposed into a tie, and this is the song Moon River transposed into a dress. Also, my house now is painted in a way that it sounds good. The living room is painted in C major, so pink, blue, pink, blue, and yellow, and then the kitchen is violet, because it's a very high-pitched note, so it keeps me alert in the kitchen. And then there's different melodies in the bathroom, so that I can listen to different songs. And the outdoor, the door is green, because green is in the middle of the spectrum, so it kind of tunes yourself before you go out in the street. The floor is red, because red is the lowest sound, so it gives a profound sound to the house. And the ceiling is black and white, because it's silent. So if I lie down, then I have silence on the ceiling. So also food has changed, because now when I eat, I can hear what I eat. So I can also compose music and eat my favorite song, depending on the disposition on the plate. And I can also now compose music by looking at things. Instead of playing an instrument, I can look at different colored objects, and then I can amplify the sounds in my head, and then I can play music to an audience by simply looking at different objects. So my experience of walking around the supermarket, for example, has changed a lot, because now for me it's just like going to a nightclub, because that's where I can hear most colors. So each aisle has its own melodies, and the cleaning product aisle is the best one, because it's the most colorful one, and unexpected notes are always there. So here's a little bit of a melody. Milk is silent. So yeah, white things and black things don't sound if there's no hue. And it's not only supermarkets, it's also museums, or art museums. Now I can go to a gallery and I can listen to a Picasso, or I can listen to an Andy Warhol. So painters have become composers. This is the scream, I can hear the scream now. It's very microtonal. There are all the notes together. And for example, Andy Warhol sounds very different. He sounds very loud. You can hear an Andy Warhol from the other end of the museum usually, because it's very saturated, so it sounds quite different. So also how I look at people has changed, because now when I look at someone, I can hear someone's face. So in 2005, Prince Charles came to the university, and he turned around and asked me what this was, and I said, it's to hear color. And then I asked him, can I listen to your face? And that was his reaction to it. So then I got close to his face, and then I wrote down the sound of his eyes, the lips, the skin, and the hair, and that was a sound portrait. So when I do this, then I can send people a sound file of their face, and each person sounds different. Judi Dench has silent hair. James Cameron has a very loud nose, because it was a shade of red. Al Gore has different colored eyes, so different notes, because it's different shades of turquoise. So each person has its own color, and it's a different way of perceiving yourself. Someone might look very beautiful but sound very unharmonic, or someone might not think that it's beautiful but then sound very, very harmonic. Moby has one note less because he has no hair, for example. Woody Allen sounds very soft, very unsaturated. Macaulay Culkin almost like C major. What I realized after years of listening to people's faces is that even twins sound different. And that most people have different shades in the eye. So you might think that you have blue eyes, but it might be slightly different, the blue from the left and the blue from the right. So this is the sound portrait. These are the five notes of one face. And then you can also... create rhythms and do face concerts. What I realized was that the people that say they're black, they're not actually black, and people that say they're white, they're not actually white. People who say they're black, they're actually very, very dark orange, and people who say they're white, they're very, very light orange. So what people say that humans are black and white is completely false. We are all orange. So that's a human color wheel of different shades of orange, red orange to yellow orange, never white and never black. This is creating rhythms with faces that allows me to do face concerts where the audience cues, and then I create different rhythms from different eyes and lips and hairs, and then this is the face concert. The face concert sounds really bad, it's the audience's fault because that's where the notes come from. And it sounds different in each country. Also, another project was to find out that cities are not gray. Each city has its own dominant colors. Also, I can transpose music to color now. This is Mozart's Queen of the Night, transposed note by note. This is Baby Baby by Justin Bieber, transposed note by note. Very different. Also, these are the Four Seasons of Vivaldi. And this is John Cage, 433, silent. And two speeches as well. Speeches, the voices of people can be transposed to color. And this is a color concert where musicians play colors instead of scores, and they use different sound palettes. This is also a street. In the street, you can use an app to hear street sculpture that has different melodies. So in 2010, I created the Cyborg Foundation with Moon Rivers with the aim to extend human senses. We believe that cyborgism can be an art movement where art is created through new senses. And this is an example of an extension of a sense. It's, you can feel movement with your eyes shut with these earrings. They vibrate whenever there's present in front of you. If you turn them around, it allows you to sense if there's someone behind you. Also, the iBook app allows you to hear colors, so you can do different projects with the sound of colors. This is a finger that allows you to extend your senses. There's a small camera inside the finger that allows you to actually detect other things through vibrations. Also, there's the internal compass that vibrates whenever you face north. It can be implanted at the bottom of your leg. So if you're in a new context, whenever you turn around, you'll feel the north. And after a while, this will become a sense. This is the first prototype of a 360-degree perception that allows you also, through bone conduction, feel your surroundings. And this is something that's not electronic or not cybernetic, but I have a tooth missing, and I wanted to have a light inside the tooth so that in case of emergency, I could just click, and then I have internal light. So... But we had a problem that when I was eating, the light was going on and off, so I had it removed. We're trying to find a way of have it reinstalled. And the seismic sense, which is the last one, is Moon Rivers feels an earthquake whenever the world shakes. So whenever there's an earthquake in the world, her elbow shakes in the same intensity, so she feels the natural movement of the earth. So she feels a strong connection with the natural movement of our planet. So to end, I think that becoming a cyborg can actually allow us to reconnect to nature in a different level. It can allow us to connect to the senses of other animal senses, of other animal species, and it can allow us to reconnect to nature and to space through new senses, basically. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Neil. That was the most fascinating presentation I've ever attended at a Buddhist conference. So the only application I could perhaps think about is let's implant all these monks and nuns with an indicator antenna to let us know how far they are from jhana, or are they in jhana stage. So the next speaker is equally interesting, and he has only one name, Stellark. And he just explained that he was from the Greek origin, and because the name was so long, that out of compassion for everyone, he has shortened it to just Stellark. So he's an artist who performs with prosthetics and robotics. His projects included the third hand, exoskeleton, extended arm, prosthetic head, and ear on arm. I'm glad I'm not giving this talk. In 1996, he was made an honorary professor of art and robotics at the Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and in 2002 was awarded an honorary doctorate of laws by Monash University, Melbourne. In 2010, he was awarded the prestigious Arts Electronica Hybrid Arts Prize. He's presently a distinguished research fellow and director of the Alternate Anatomies Lab School of Art at the Curtin University in Perth. His artwork is represented by Scott Livesey Galleries, Melbourne. So join me to welcome Stellark, please.
thanks very much. I guess being interested in the evolutionary architecture of the body, the more performances I did, the more I realised that the body was profoundly obsolete. And also, the more and more projects and performances I do, the less and less I think I have a mind of my own, nor any mind at all, in the traditional metaphysical sense. We can now preserve dead bodies indefinitely with plastination, at the same time that we can sustain comatose bodies indefinitely on life support systems. So, dead bodies need no longer disintegrate, near dead bodies need not die, and it's a time of what I call circulating flesh. We can take the hands of a cadaver and animate them on the on an amputee, for example. Or we can take a heart from one person's body and insert it into another. So flesh is circulating. In fact, in terms of the imbalance of males and females, just a warning. We can now take the skin cells from an impotent male and turn them into sperm cells. But more interestingly, we can take the skin cells from a female body and turn them into sperm cells. which means that males are out of the reproductive loop. So as well as a time of circulating flesh, it's also a time of what I call fractal flesh and phantom flesh. By fractal flesh, I mean bodies and bits of bodies spatially separated but electronically connected, generating patterns of interactivity at varying scales. And by phantom flesh, I mean bodies not only performing as their avatars, but also with the proliferation of haptic devices on the internet, we'll be able to feel the remote person in a more potent way. The third hand was the first attachment to my body in 1980, EMG controlled by your abdominal leg muscles, generating independent movements of the three hands. And initially this was just a visual performance object on my body. But I tried to do things like here, writing one word simultaneously with each hand writing a separate letter at the same time. And because this performance was on a sheet of glass, I had to learn to write evolution back to front. An ambidextrous arm. If you're an amputee and you lost your hand, what about replacing it with a hand that is ambidextrously designed? Fingers bend one way, the thumb rotates, you've got a right hand. But your fingers can, in this design, can bend completely the other way. The thumb can rotate backwards, so you have a left hand and a right hand all in one. And this hand will also have a webcam in the palm of its hand to enable it to be a disembodied mobile eye. In this performance, laser beams are directed to the eyes via fiber optic cables. They are modulated with the heartbeat sound, whilst my abdominal leg muscles are controlling my third hand. The sounds that you will hear will be amplified body signals like brain waves, heartbeat, blood flow and muscle signals. So the body not only has a kind of visual projection and with eyes generating images, but also has an acoustical aura of its body signals and sounds. Stand up, please, higher. So the performance began when the body was switched off, and the performance ended when the body was switched off. The extended arm. In this performance, my left arm is computer controlled by a muscle stimulation system. So my left arm is involuntarily moving whilst my right arm is extended with an 11 degree of freedom manipulator. So it was a kind of split physiology, not a split mind and body, but a split body. The left side voltage in, involuntary movements, the right side voltage out, having this extended arm. It didn't take much to think, though, that if you could program the body to move involuntarily in a local space, you could do this remotely. And in 1996, an event called Telepolis, people in the Pompidou Centre in Paris, the Media Lab in Helsinki, and the Doors of Perception Conference in Amsterdam, by touching the computer model of the body and by programming it, by touching it, and the computer model simulates the movement that you've programmed. A second later, in Luxembourg, where my body moved involuntarily. So I did not have any control of my body, but I did have control of my third hand. I also did have a head-up display, so I could see the face of the person who was moving me. And there were malicious agents on the internet, because not believing in the system, they kept programming the same repetitive movement over and over again. And over 2 days, this became very, very fatiguing. But a body in this kind of situation is simultaneously a possessed and performing body. Partially possessed, producing involuntary movements, partially performing with its own agency. As well as attaching technology externally to the body, in 1993 I designed a sculpture for the inside of my body. A sculpture designed for the inside of my stomach. And if you can imagine, with the help of a friendly endoscopist, this was inserted 40 centimetres into my stomach cavity. The stomach was inflated with air to make it safe to insert. And inside the stomach, the sculpture opens and closes, extends and retracts, has a flashing light and a beeping sound. So you have to imagine this as a simple machine choreography inside a wet and normally dark part, soft part of the body. Now, another project, which was the kind of inverse of the stomach sculpture, in collaboration with another artist, Nina Sellers, 4.6 litres of our biomaterial, extracted biomaterial, was inserted, hermetically sealed, in an installation called Blender. The compressed bottles of air every 5 minutes actuated the blender blades, mixing the biomaterial from two artists' bodies. So here, a machine installation becomes the host for a liquid body composed of biomaterial from two artists' bodies. And it was anthropomorphic in scale. The ear project began initially as an ear designed for the side of my head. This was first imaged in 1997, but we couldn't get surgical assistance to do such a procedure on the side of my head because of the fear of partial face paralysis. I always imagined this might happen, for example, in Brazil, where they do radical sex change operations. But if it had happened in Brazil, upon awakening, I might have wondered what organ had been stitched to the side of my head. I've been called those names before. But this surely would have been a slide into monstrosity. But in 2006, with funding from a London production company, this is a scanning of my ear, a scanning of my arm, we did the first surgical procedures. The first one, in fact, was to insert an inflating prosthesis that produced a pocket of stretched skin, excess skin. And here the scaffold is inserted beneath the skin. The skin is suctioned over the scaffold. And after 6 months, this encourages what's known as tissue ingrowth and vascularization to occur. So the ear becomes part of your arm, and it even grows its own blood supply. It's only a relief veneer. I don't know if you have a good view of it there. You can have a closer look later. It's only a relief veneer. It still needs to be lifted. The helix needs to be lifted for an ear flap. We're going to grow a soft earlobe using my adult stem cells. And then when it's a truly three-dimensional ear, we'll reinsert the small microphone into the ear and internet-enable the ear. So if you're here in Perth, I'm in London, New York, wherever I am, wherever you are, you'll be able to listen into what the ear is hearing. Now, I showed this to a two-year-old girl who looked at the ear on my arm. It seemed as if she recognised it was an ear, because the first thing she wanted to do was examine the left side of my head as if the ear had slipped off somehow onto my arm. You can see here that even though we're wrapping the arm with bandages, you can see that the surgeon's voice is being picked up and wirelessly transmitted. The ear was in there activated for a couple of weeks before it had to be removed. This generated a couple of other performances at the Lawn Sculpture Tree in Arlay. I made a large sculpture of the ear on my arm, 4 metres long, and I decided to lie on the sculpture. My body was smeared with white clay, which cracked over the period of the performance. So the body became, the whole physical body became a part of this large fragment of the body, which was the ear on the arm. But whilst lying on this sculpture, I thought it would be a really interesting performance if I could be suspended above the sculpture. And several years ago, I decided to do this with the insertion of 16 hooks into the back, so the body could be horizontally suspended, only about 50 centimetres above the sculpture. Now, I guess the way to describe what's happening here is that the body is performing with a posture of indifference. In other words, there are no expectations. The performance is not scripted. It's certainly structured, but you perform with indifference. You allow things to happen in their own way, in their own time, with their own rhythm, and of course, you trust your assistants. And as the body, as the cable assumes the full weight of the body, because the cable is braided, it slowly untwists and the body spins around. I thought I would only be spinning for 5 minutes. It ended up for 15. And this performance is a performance that I'd like to finish up on. I'm actuating my prosthetic head, a 3D model, with the artist's face texture, and my arm gestures are generating the choreography of the head and what the head is sounding like or singing. With the system, because the Kinect sensor could only really recognise certain gestures. but it was what was happening in between those recognition of the six gestures that made the performance interesting. And this is a kind of actual virtual interface where a physical body is animating and interacting with a virtual entity. And to finish up, and another indication in addition to Neil's of how technology can radically interrogate what a body is and how a body operates. Several years ago, the first turbine artificial heart was inserted into the chest of a terminally ill patient. This turbine heart is interesting because it's more robust and smaller than previous artificial hearts. But it circulates the blood continuously without pulsing. So, in the near future, you might rest your head on your loved one's chest. They're breathing. They're speaking. They're certainly alive, but they have no heartbeat.
Your ear on the arm.
Well, I thought Neil's presentation was most unusual. This one's pretty mind-blowing. And perhaps we can preserve Ajahn Brahm in the future using the technology that he mentioned. And when Neil said you could plant a little chip on your toe to kind of figure out the sense of direction, I think that might be very helpful to many of us women who may not have a great sense of direction as the men tell us. Well, let's see if we can get any weirder. We have the third non-Sangha speaker on this panel. He's Guy Benori. He's recognized internationally as a major artist and innovator working across science and media arts. He specializes in biotechnological artwork, which aims to enrich our understanding of what it means to be alive. His main research areas are cybernetics, robotics, and interface of biological material to robotics. Guy's work has been shown at prestigious venues and festivals from the Beijing National Art Museum to San Paolo Biennale to the Moscow Biennale. His work can also be seen in permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And in 2009, his work Silent Barrage won first prize at VIDA, a significant international competition for art and artificial life. So welcome, Guy. Blow our mind out.
Right, thank you very much, and thank you, Raj, for inviting me. It is a little bit unfair to speak after those two. I'll do my best. So my name is Guy, and I'm a co-researcher and an artist in residence in Symbiotica, the Center for Excellence in Biological Arts. If you can just put it, yeah, thank you. In UWA, it's quite a interesting lab directed by Oren Katz, and this lab is dedicated to curiosity-based research into biological arts, the interface between art and science. We're a bunch of artists that are using biological technologies and explore contestable future scenarios to try and imagine how our future is going to be and look like. As I said, I'm a researcher and artist, and I consider myself to be a new media artist. That's kind of the cultural sphere that I work in. I use emerging technologies, mainly biological technologies and robotics, biological materials, and rather than making, I grow things. One of the main strategies that I usually employ in my work is to problematize the technologies by putting forward absurd scenarios and contestable scenarios. And this strategy is being used usually to get the viewers, the people that are interested in what I do, to think about the implications of those technologies about our future. Most of the research that I'm looking at is about life, biology, life. And I'm working at the School of Anatomy and Human Biology using those technologies to kind of look at those technologies that allow us to manipulate life, to change our human body, to change what we know or what we perceive as living or non-living. I mean, there's a gap between the cultural understanding of what life is and the scientific definition of life is. And this gap is where my research and my interest lies. I just want to start by reading this quote because it kind of sets up the framework and the basis for my research or quite a lot of artists in Symbiotica. There's a quote by Stephen Wilson. The motivation of artists, I think like a lot of, there's a lot of people that are asking us, I mean, is it art and why is it art and why are you doing it? And I find this quote to be quite explanatory. The motivation of artists that research new technologies in technology or science is different to scientists to technologies. It is not for profit or primary utilization. The artists undertake to develop tools that help realize an artistic goal or a cultural agenda. Cultural commentary and the construction of hidden narratives in cultural structures are very important. Critique idealized vision, what we do is to critique idealized visions of science and demystify science and empower the public to participate in the dialogue. So in the last 15 years, my main kind of area of research is neuroscience. And in the last couple of years, I kind of dived into stem cell technology. Again, I mean, the research is curiosity-based research. It's a non-utilitarian research. And I like these slides because it kind of shows that, you know, neuroscience can, you know, from cognitive sciences to molecular or biology or biochemistry, you know, there's a whole range of kind of work that is done or kind of levels to kind of the research. And where my interest lies is what those thousands of cells are doing. So I use technologies such as tissue culture and tissue engineering to grow brain cells. And at this point, well, I'll wait for that. I mean, we grow neurons, and just to kind of remind you, neurons are the kind of basic unit that makes up our brain. I mean, that's kind of oversimplifying it, but that's kind of the main thing. And, you know, I mean, they're made from axons and dendrites and the cell bodies. There's input and output. And, you know, once they're in the biological network, there's data that is being processed and transferred between the components that make up the brain. And the data that I'm talking about in scientific terms, it's called action potentials. Once the neurons are firing, the data or the action potentials are kind of stimulating other neurons in the network, and data is kind of transferred in the brain and to kind of the organs or the rest of the body. And again, I mean, if there are scientists here, I am oversimplifying it just for the sake of time and to move on to the work itself. I make brains, I bioengineer brains, but I have to qualify the word brain here. I'm not making, a brain is a three-dimensional organ, and it's made out of billions of cells and trillions of synapses, and it evolved for millions of years, you know, to be working and have a very specific function. Every neuron in the brain is there for a reason, and the location and the relationship to other neurons is very important. So I don't make brains as such. The brains that I make are quite symbolic, but they still allow me to kind of bring them into the cultural spheres and ask questions about the future possibilities of those neurons. The brains that I make are made out of their neural networks, and they're made out of somewhere around 80 to 200,000 neurons, and they grow. I grow them in in tissue culture labs, and once they're kind of plated in those kind of specialized interfaces, they form a neural network, and the neurons kind of are living quite chaotic in this kind of environment, but they start processing the data. And I grow them on those specialized interfaces called multi-electrode arrays. It's petri dishes that the neurons grow in, and in the base there are 60 electrodes that are kind of point of interface. This is my read and write interface to those neurons. Each one of those electrodes can record the electric signals that the neurons produce at this point. But at the same time, we can stimulate the neurons at 60 points on the dish. So really, I have here an interface to and from those neural networks. And as an artist, I found that quite interesting. You know, I mean, it's, I kind of started to think about the chaotic existence of those disembodied neurons. The neurons that you take outside of the body of the animal, whether it's an animal or humans or mice, whatever it is, those neurons still, they exist outside of the body. They're disembodied, but they still produce data, and they still live, and they still generate interactions between themselves. And this chaotic existence of them was of interest to me. This is a multi-electrode array dish, this interface dish that I grow the neurons in the lab outside of the body. And just to kind of give you an example of what sort of data, or how do we hear this data, I have this plot here. You can have volume, please. So here we kind of heard kind of a recording of 10 seconds of the neurons kind of with a spontaneous activity, but when you heard this barrage of activity, that was how the neurons respond to the stimulations that we send them. So if they respond to them like that, something is happening there, and in my mind, you know, I could start interacting with them. I could actually start telling those neurons about things that are happening in this outside world. So the first project that I've been engaged with, we produced, first of all, I'm just going to qualify it. Those projects are the result of a collaboration between artists and scientists and engineers. I don't do them myself. I wish I could, but I can't, even though the collaboration is quite enriching and I like it. So at the end, we're going to mention some names, but MeArt was MeArt, the semi-living artist, was the first project where we started to kind of try and hook those external brains to robotic bodies. We decided to give those disembodied neurons, those disembodied brains, a body to interact with. And when we thought about what sort of, you know, when we work with the scientists, most scientists are using utilitarian kind of tasks for the neurons. Navigate here, go there, follow instructions. We decided to give those disembodied brains, one of the most the opposite of utilitarian, the non-utilitarian kind of task, and that's being an artist. So we decided to give this disembodied brain a robotic arm that would draw two-dimensional drawings. I think that what's interesting to kind of mention is that the brain, at the time, I didn't have access to the technology that allowed me to kind of do these kind of recordings and interaction with the brain. Oh my God, this is, the brain was grown in a lab in Atlanta, and the body was wherever we exhibited it around the world. So there was some sort of a ubiquitous existence of this distributed entity between the U.S. and Melbourne. That's another project that, because of lack of time, I won't talk about it, but again, I mean, those kind of a biological brain in an immersive robotic environment. Then I kind of learned about a technology called iPS, where you can reprogram cells. So you can take an adult skin cell and then reprogram it to be a stem cell, a cell that has the potential of becoming any other cell in the body, and then differentiate it to other types of cells. And this kind of biological alchemy The transformation of biological materials was of quite interest for me, and I came up with this project. And I wanted to kind of be playful with this project, problematize the technology as suggested to get people to think about it, and I decided to take cells from foreskin. You can buy them on online catalogs on the internet. Well, I bought some foreskin cells and I turned them to be neurons. And this is how, so we took foreskin and turned it into a brain. And this is how it looked. And what we did here, we actually took the brain that originated from foreskin and put it on a pedestal and asked people to think about what is this brain. And also we challenged the Western white Western kind of idea of what is a person, because according to that, it's that the idea of a person is someone that his brain is working. So here we put a functional brain, quote unquote, that is originated from foreskin on a pedestal, and we asked, is this a person? Then I want to talk about the current project that I'm developing called Self, and that's my self-portrait. Once I kind of work with foreskin cells, I realized that I can actually work with myself. I had a biopsy taken from my arm, and then I grew my skin cells in vitro. You can see here, this is me growing outside of my body. As opposed to Neil and Stellart, I do work with my body, but then I kind of take the material and take it out of my body. I grew my skin cells, and even though that's beautiful, we don't have really time to indulge with that. And then I reprogrammed my own skin cells into stem cells. So this clump or colony in the middle, those are my stem cells. They're kind of equal to 3 weeks of an embryo in a uterus. And then I differentiated then those stem cells into neurons. Those are my neurons. This is my external brain. And while talking to you right now, there's probably 50 dishes with my little brains in an incubator in UWA, just the other side of the river. This is another kind of illustration of my external brain. And then I kind of said, okay, so what sort of body would I give myself? What sort of self-portrait would you like to create? And I didn't want to create another version of me. I didn't want a self-portrait. I decided to go on a quest of realizing one of my childhood dreams, to be a rock and roll star. So this is what I wanted to be. And I decided to give my body, to give my external brain, the brain that is growing in those incubators right now, and sound-producing body, a modular analog synthesizer. And it kind of made sense because, you know, the way those analog synthesizers work is very similar to the way neural networks work. There's a control voltage that moves between components. So my external brain is now interfaced to synthesizers with the help of this kind of interface, but then I kind of thought to myself, so where is the feedback? How are you going to interact with the outside world? And the way I'm going to do it, it's like this self, this cybernetic musician, my external brain connected to the synthesizers, is going to jam with human musicians, where the musicians are going to play. It's like a jam session, like a jazz improvisation session, where the human music of the first performance is going to be with a drummer, is going to be streamed into my external brain through this interface, stimulate the neurons. The neurons are going to control the synthesizers, and then there's going to be some sort of a jam session between the human and the non-human music. And with your permission, my time is over, I would just kind of play one more thing. And this is from a little kind of test of a prototype that we did last week. This is how it sounded. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, guys, for that very brain-blowing presentation. I used to think it wasn't true when people say men have two brains, but now it's scientifically proven. And now our last speaker for this panel is Dr. Damis.
Just interrupt briefly. Sorry if I just interrupt briefly. I just wanted to say I can't resist this. As an excess musician, right, listening to that, it sounded like this kind of clawing towards rhythm, that kind of thing. It was kind of, I heard it in the lab a few months ago, and it's definitely, the work on the middle eight is definitely better than it was before. But when I was in my band, I have to say this, I'm sorry, this is a very bad joke, but it's true. When I was in my band, we used to sing a song called A Brain in a Jar. I kid you not. And now you can sing a song with a brain in a jar. And that's progress. Yeah.
Thank you, Bhante. So now we have a co-founder of Robological, a Sydney-based robotics R&D startup. It was named one of the 23 most innovative young technology companies in Australia in 2014. After graduating in production engineering from the University of Peradeniya, Sri Lanka, he initially worked in industry, subsequently becoming a researcher, engineer, and a consultant in fields as diverse as robotics, art, and psychology. He earned a PhD in robotics at the University of Technology, Sydney, and led a number of multidisciplinary robotic research projects at the Marx Institute, University of Western Sydney. So these projects received widespread recognition, and the speaker was co-chair of the International Conference on Social Robotics in 2014. Please welcome Dr. Damis Herat.
Thanks, Sanjeev. After the cyborgs, the Jedi Knight, and the brains, I don't know what I'm going to say. So much pressure. So, may all sentient beings be happy and well. I think what's underrepresented here is robots. We got cyborgs and all kind of biological stuff. And Bhante Sujato actually asked me to bring a robot. And currently I work with this guy, 9 feet tall and about 200 kilograms. And I told Bhante that it's probably difficult to tag along with him on the flight from Sydney to Perth. So I had to leave that guy there. But I managed to nick the robot that my son looks after, or the other way around when he's bored. So what I'll do, I'll turn this guy on. That's it. So I'll leave it there. He got some AI built in, artificial intelligence, so he might actually enjoy my talk. If not, he might fall asleep down the track. So that will be an indication when to shut up. When I was about 8 years old, waking up 5:30 a.m. in the morning was the hardest thing to do. Apart from going to school after that. You had to wake up, get off the bed, open the curtains, and also then prepare your breakfast, get ready, get dressed, and so many chores. So I hated that, especially when you have to do that 5:30 a.m. in the morning. I always wished a robot could come with the breakfast in the morning, 5:30, feed me and dress me up, and when I'm kind of ready, then lift me up and take to the bus stop, which then take the 1 hour journey to my school. And I was always hoping that that would happen sometime sooner than later. And then I started building robots fairly young. I was drawn to robotics at a very early age, but also drawn to art as well. I'm fortunate that I get to work with some of these guys on robotic art projects now. One of my earliest memories of building robots is when I was about 12 years. We built this robot. If you've seen Buck Rogers in the 70s and 80s, they had a robot called Tweaky. We built this robot out of wood, so I got actually an older kid to carve it out from wood, and what we did was actually put some motors so that it can actually move forward and backwards, and put a little speaker and amplifier in its head. And this was for a school exhibition. I distinctly remember that's probably where I had my first experience with entrepreneurship, because what my mates and I conjured up is actually, if somebody puts 1 rupee coin in there, the robot would speak. So we had one of my mates hiding inside the desk with a mic, and whenever the guy puts a 1 rupee coin in there, then he said, "How are you, mate?" or whatever. And these guys are, "Oh, this is actually a fairly intelligent machine. Can I ask a question?" "Yes." And so this got actually quite popular, and it actually went to the head teacher. And she found out that we kind of scamming people and actually, you know, siphoning money from exhibition visitors. So we had to shut down our operation, but not before we had a few coins to go to the canteen and get some nibblies. And so that was one of my first experiences with robotics and entrepreneurship. And I'm to this date doing both of that plus ethics. So where is artificial intelligence? I mean, there's a lot of people worrying about artificial intelligence becoming malevolent. But I think that's not possible if you look at it from a Buddhist perspective. Now, for a minute, let's do a little thought experiment. Imagine that if a robot becomes sentient, and assume, because this has to be a very intelligent machine, the first thing would realize that, you know, now I'm sentient, I'm a being. And the second thing that should come to its mind is that, hey, now that I am a being, I seem to be a bit disconcerted with this existence. You know, from a Buddhist perspective, you should realize that there's subtle suffering the moment you become aware. So the moment that thought comes into the robot, the AI system, it should be thinking, all right, this is not right. There should be an answer to this. And a robot of this nature would have infinite access to the knowledge, and it'd find some of the Buddhist texts and talking about suffering and the way of ending suffering. And it would realize that I need to be artificially enlightened. So I think the next thing that robot would do is actually turn himself off. artificial intelligence become really super intelligent and sentient, I think they'll start turning themselves off fairly quickly. So that kind of system probably is useless. So having jokes aside, let's just explore a little bit what intelligence means in a machine. Now I'm going to do a little social experiment. I'm going to play a little video. So there's two robots here interacting with each other, and you see that yellow robot is quite familiar. If you can look at the bald-headed face, that might resemble somebody that's quite familiar. We call that articulated head. So it's an industrial robot arm mounted with a monitor displaying Stellark's prosthetic head, obviously. And the other robot is a two-wheeled robot called a PeopleBot, for whatever ironical reasons. So these two are interacting. Now, one of them has actually some intelligence built into it. So one of my colleagues has programmed a certain artificial intelligence into it. Now, I want to look at the interaction and see if you can work out which of these robots is the intelligent one. It's no insult to Stellark. So if you think it's the yellow robot, the articulated head with the head, could you please raise your hands? Don't be shy. Not you. If you think it's the mobile platform, Could you raise your hands, please? It's quite interesting. I think just to give a bit of a reflection, the most hands were raised for the people, but the one that's kind of moving around. Okay. Now, the way we set this experiment up is actually the artificial intelligence is built into the articulated head that's behind the screen. The Stellark set actually had some intelligence in it. No pun intended. The platform that's running around is actually meant to be random movement, but it's controlled by a human operator. So the instruction that was given to the human operator was to control it in a random sense. So you see, intelligence is a fairly deceiving concept in when you think about machines. So how we do this? This is quite a simplified way how we engineers think about robotic systems. So it's kind of like a human. You got your senses to see the world, and then you got algorithms, the kind of the brain-like structure that perceives that world using the senses and come up with actions. So these algorithms are more like recipes of what to do when you see something or how you recognize something in the world. For instance, if you want to tell a robot what a cat is, the first thing a robotist would do is actually figure out how you describe a robot in zeros and ones, because robots work in zeros and ones, computers work in zeros and ones. So it really boils down to at the base is you are representing the world with numbers and equations. So you can do this in a number of different ways. One of the foremost one is it actually come up with a mathematical equation for whatever you want the robot to understand. So in this instance, if you want to tell what a cat is to a robot, you will actually try to work out some equations describing what a cat is mathematically. But as you can understand, that's a fairly onerous task. So what you normally would do is the second option, which is called developing a learning algorithm. So there's supervised learning. So I'll create a supervised learning algorithm, and I'll collect a number of these cat photos and churn it through this algorithm and say, look, that's a cat, these are cats, learn it. So it'll detect some of the features and it'll create a mathematical representation of that. And then the next time when I show a figure with a cat, it'll say, oh, I can see a cat there. So what it boils down to at the end is actually what the robot is doing is basically doing pattern recognition and nothing more. So the argument for artificial intelligence becoming malevolent one day is based on the theory that we are increasing the computational power every day, and we are creating more sophisticated algorithms, and that we can run them using these fast computers. And also we are creating more larger databases like the Google, for instance, where you have access to large set of data. So the scientists kind of hypothesized, so this is in the 90s, so in another 20 years, about 2030, we'll have computers that are equivalent to human brains. So that just meant to sleep. So I think this is in a very false hypothesis, because what you're essentially doing is increasing the performance of these algorithms. The algorithm wouldn't know what a catness is. It would know what a cat looks like, but it doesn't really know what catness is. So I think we don't have to fear of AI becoming malevolent in any immediate future, because we probably can't create that kind of intelligence. So in summary, more data and more computing power doesn't necessarily mean super intelligence in the human context. So what is the missing link here? I think it's the consciousness. This is probably something that you're familiar with. I've simplified the Buddhist notion of consciousness and how that interacts with sense bases. So in this sense, the brain, the mental sense organ, as well as the vision, the eyes, nose, and all that, it's kind of lumped into the sense basis. So when you have external objects that come into contact with the sense organs, that creates, and that when that comes to contact with consciousness, that's when you become aware of yourself, and all that follows from it. So I think a way to create actual intelligence on a chip is to look at this from that perspective. So I think consciousness in a way is more like an energy source or some phenomenon that exists in this universe. It's kind of like the electromagnetic field that, you know, when you turn on the TV, what happens is actually some of these signals get connected to the antenna, and the antenna, the signals get converted to the vision and sound. So similar way, if you can connect that consciousness to a machine, and I think we now have the tools to do that because with Guy Benari's brain, external brains, maybe there's already consciousness in there. Okay, so that's probably what making these noises and music. So I think the way to create intelligence on a chip is to actually invite consciousness into these scaffolds, like what Benari is creating, and that connect that to processes. So one day, if you want to create very malevolent robotic platforms, the way to do is to actually augment that machine part with some kind of brain structure like what Guy Benari is creating. And so I think the way we are looking at with AI right now, I don't think there is a direct path to becoming this AI becoming conscious. But if we can combine some of the technology that was described earlier, and according to Buddhist principles, you know, you can create life forms from different ways. So we might be able to invite consciousness to come into one of these brain structures and control, take possession of these machines that way. So in that sense, these robots can become malevolent because humans could go either way. So they could be, you know, malevolent or benevolent depending on their consciousness states. So the message is that AI is a tool, and how you use it will dictate the way it's being perceived by the world. So AI tool can be used for goodness or badness. And as you know, that, you know, some of the technology is already being used in wars and things like that. For instance, the drones, they already have AI that drives them, but they are controlled by humans. So it's up to us, the humans, to work out what kind of ethics we apply to robotic technologies. So really don't fear AI is taking over the world. I think it's more important that we look after ourselves, the human mind, and that's the only way to create artificial intelligence and artificial enlightenment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Damit. And now we shall be opening up the floor for questions. And I'm sure you've got loads of questions after four very exciting presentations. So before we have anyone queuing up, we already have one there. Okay, please go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm just observing as this question of to any one of the five speakers is, are we creating here a highly intelligent Buddhist Frankenstein here? Yeah, I mean, with the whole five speakers, you can just create that.
Okay, is that your
question?
Okay, great. I'm going to hand this to Bhante Sujato first. That's the sound effect, right?
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for that, Angie. Yeah, that's good. Buddhist Frankenstein. Well, I think Frankenstein, it's been a long time since I read that story, but if I remember correctly, Frankenstein was okay until he got messed up by his creator, wasn't it? I mean, the monster himself was fine. But, you know, if you got all the technologies, I mean, it's one of the things, if you get all the technologies that you're talking about, right, the artificial intelligence, the robotics, the growing of neurons, the augmented sensors and all of these kinds of things, and then you have us, you sort of, it's cascading into the future, isn't it? I mean, we can imagine what these things might be like in 20 years' time, right? But can we imagine what it's going to be like in 20,000 years' time? Right? I mean, assuming that human civilization remains and assuming that we keep on evolving, right? Big assumptions, I know, but I mean, if that happens, could we imagine what is going to be possible in that kind of timescale? And I don't think we can, but I think we can say that from a Buddhist point of view, we can say that there will still be suffering, and that all of these forms of whatever form of intelligence or sentience and so on and so forth that we have, it will still be related to suffering in some way. We can increase suffering if we use it badly, we can decrease suffering by using it well. And so any technological change needs, to my mind, needs to be guided by that kind of sense. And we've seen, for example, in recent weeks, quite a well-publicized statement saying there should be like ethical guidelines for AIs in military applications. You would know autonomous drones. And so I don't know if you signed that petition, but I signed it. And, you know, to me, that's kind of stepping over a line when you have autonomous military entities fighting wars, right? And so to my mind, this is one of the motivations that I had when I suggested this, having this forum, was to bring these technologies into a context where we're considering it within a spiritual and an ethical environment.
Okay, thank you for that. And does anybody?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that at least my motivation as an artist to pursue and research those technologies is this idea that actually I heard Stellart said the first time a long time ago, the contestable futures. You know, those technologies are around us and they're being used. And we are very far from creating Frankenstein, of course, and I can understand why the first thing that one can think of is Frankenstein. But I think that what the work that we're doing as artists is one of the reasons that I, at least, am doing it is to generate this kind of public discussion and kind of to bring awareness, whether it's a Buddhist kind of approach or a Western approach, but the idea of kind of awareness, public awareness to those technologies and kind of initiating some sort of dialogue about what are the ethical and practical considerations that we need to take while kind of getting ready for those kind of scary, pleasant, I don't know, I mean, we all kind of have different kind of perceptions of what is going to be kind of futures.
Well, this is a really interesting discussion. I mean, one has to remember that in a way the body has already become a kind of contemporary chimera. I mean, the mythological chimera was, you know, human and animal constructs. But we've already become kind of contemporary chimeras of meat, metal and code. You know, humans are not merely biological bodies. They're biological bodies. They're increasingly extended, enhanced by their technologies, and they have to manage data in virtual systems. So the biological body is really a kind of romantic throwback on what a body is. In a sense, you know, we've always feared the zombie, because it performs involuntarily and doesn't seem to have a mind of its own. We're anxious about becoming automated, in other words, becoming cyborgs, but in fact we fear what we have always been and what we have already become. We were always zombie-like bodies and we're already cyborgs.
And if I may add, for someone who has been in the technology world, over 30 years ago when I was studying artificial intelligence in the university, and frankly, it hasn't really progressed that much. And today, even the healthcare system is struggling just to get a robot that's going to be able to help in the healthcare world. And it might become very, very useful, especially when you have a robot to care for someone with dementia, because at least the robot will answer the same question over and over again without getting upset and be able to feed this person in a very gentle and kind manner, which most humans are not necessarily able to when things are becoming very repetitive. So, you know, there you go. And the drones are meant to help preserve lives in the Air Force, because they are going to be attacking using people in the control center without risking people in the planes going out into the war zone. So that's some of the interesting aspects of robotics, which I was also exposed to just very recently at the University of Sydney during one of my trips. Yeah, second question, please.
Thank you. My name is Sunil Govind again. I'm a Perth resident. I'm here on the 9th Global Conference on Buddhism. The theme is resolving conflict with mindfulness. With apology to Bhante Sujato, I'm wondering how this particular session is relating to the main theme. So, and also I'm really puzzled as an academic who's researching on public policy in a tertiary institute to learn about how the foreskins cells are being converted, and it really raised the ethical question of, you know, allocation of resources. So I really want to ask directly, what is the kind of ethics committee that you have really got approval? Because some of my taxpayers' money would have gone to that absurd research. Because science is there to eradicate, to bring happiness to people, in my understanding. We have eradicated diseases such as smallpox. Now we have invented a vaccination to eradicate malaria. We have really invented a vaccination against Ebola. So when this young scientist from my country, Perth, is really doing this absurd research from my point of view. So look, as that as a prologue, and I think this is a clever strategy. Probably Thanachan Braham has really given us to understand the absurdity of science. Okay. In
so
general.
Let's just stop
so
there
I really
for now.
And a chance to really give.
Yeah.
I just now, if this, I'm a consumer here, I
yes.
came to look wisdom. So really, I'm happy about the session. So I really want to get a rational explanation about the relevance of this speech, apart from Bhante Sujato, to the main theme of the conference.
You have just uncovered the conflict. The conflict is about you paying tax and what's being used for. So Bhante Sujato is going to apply mindfulness to respond to your question. He's still contemplating.
Well, I won't answer how is it relevant to the conference. I'll let you do that. But first of all, for your first question about the ethical committees that I go through, as a researcher in UWA, the University of Western Australia, that is performing research using biological material, I am committed to go, or I'm obliged to go through, and we do, the ethical committees of UWA, whether it's the animal committee, ethics committee, or the human ethics committee, and every single project that is being developed in Symbiotica, the research lab that I'm working with, is going through the same kind of process of going through those committees. Now, in your question, I think that what you did, whether you meant or not, is undermining cultural research. You did say that the scientific research is quite important, and what I did understand from the way you kind of asked your question is that you're undermining the cultural research, and I don't disagree with you. I do think that the cultural research and the cultural articulation of biological technologies is of immense importance, and we should not undermine it, because those technologies are changing our definitions about life, what life is. You know, the taxonomy, the language, the vocabulary, and the question of what is alive and is not alive are real questions, and they, in light of those developments in kind of biotechnologies, they're very, very relevant. And what we're doing is we're trying to answer those questions. Whether we're using foreskin cells, which is skin cells, or other type of cells for our kind of work is important for the narrative of the work itself, but it's irrelevant to the question of the importance of the research that we're doing, which is to look at the impact, cultural articulation, the cultural impact of those technologies of us as a society, as human beings, and the question of what it is to be alive in the 21st century.
Uh,
chances to
I might as well just add a little bit, because I'm being the probably the ex-artist here, and also being an engineer, a research scientist. Before becoming involved with these guys, one of the questions that I had was actually the same thing, you know, why we spend a lot of money in cultural studies and things like that, and Salak's work. And Salak actually used to joke that when you apply for ARC funding, he would actually be left out, because when an artist apply for this kind of research, you won't get it. That's the sad reality. I used to work with Salak on an ARC-funded research project a few years back, and one of the outcomes was that articulated that you saw there. Now, it was conceived as an art project, and it was meant to be an art installation. But with some of the colleagues that I worked with in psychology and engineering and computer sciences, we actually developed some of the most interesting ideas and algorithms that contributed to the AI research realm. So we actually ended up winning Engineering Excellence Awards in 2012, I think. So just to point out that, you know, some of these research that might look very superficial in that sense for somebody from the science background, we actually end up creating some really fantastic technology. And the company that I'm currently working with is actually a spin-off of Stellar's direct work. So I think art and culture studies actually informs the engineers to think ahead. I might also add that because I've been involved with arts now for quite some time, and we have a few workshops with cross researchers. So a few years back, we did a workshop on robotics and art. We invited, you know, people from multiple disciplines, and we had a mini workshop within the workshop, what's called the prototyping future. So we actually got somebody from Intel. Just for the curiosity of you there, Intel actually has a person titled a future caster. So this guy's work is actually, he gets quite a lot of money to do his work. He just sits there and writes science fiction novels. And these novels then convert into technological ideas for the engineers to work on. These projects are not for the immediate future. It's for like 10, 20 years. So one of my working hypotheses now with working with artists is that they actually show us different ways of looking at creating new technologies, new ideas for the future, for benefit of every sentient being, that engineers would not have thought. Just a point case again with Apple and Microsoft. I mean, Microsoft has some fantastic engineers, obviously, but their products are crap. Right. I hope that you agree with that. But on the other hand, Apple is far better too. So again, I think when you want to create exceptional research, I think you need all these disciplines to work together. I know that it's really hard. I mean, I actually pretty much got expelled from university for doing that. Because it's just hard, because you don't fit into a category then, because I'm not a scientist anymore, because I work with artists, and I have artistic outcomes which doesn't exist in the realm of scientific research. So I'll you know, put that, my kind of, you know, professional existence into line working with these guys. But we've got a company, and we're actually working towards, you know, building new technologies, which was actually thankfully inspired by Stellar. So I think that kind of questions are really, you know, mundane sort of question that you, when you haven't really looked at it. So that's my
answer.
But let's face it. I mean, artists like to mess with technology, to come up with unexpected and contestable possibilities. And it's not about research in the methodological sort of scientific sense. It's more about experimenting, considering possibilities that perhaps within the rigid scientific methodologies are not considered. I think this is an approach that artists will take. And this kind of messing with technology is really important, because it interrogates what it means to do this kind of research. It's not utilitarian, and therefore, in a sense, it's a more kind of pure play, pure kind of research. It doesn't have an outcome that is for profit or for some utilitarian use.
Thank you for that, Philip. And did you want to say something, Bunny?
Maybe in relation to what we are doing here, I think the use of technology as an extension of our minds will affect mindfulness in many different ways. Also, the extension of sense and perception of reality will also change the way we resolve many conflicts. So there is a relationship, I think, depending on how you read all these different works, you can find your own message.
Sorry, did you want to say?
Well, the question was addressed to me, so I thought I might say a couple of words. But one thing which has struck me listening to in all the presentations this afternoon was that actually I was going to use the same words Phil just used of play, and the other word which sort of struck me was DIY. Like all of you guys just get in there and start hacking stuff, right? You know, with Dominic, the story when you were a kid, you just get bits of wood and put it together and try to make it a robot out of it. And to me, there's something quite empowering about that because I think we're living in a world where technology is more and more being taken out of our hands and being monopolized by big corporations. Maybe a generation ago, most people knew the machines that are around them, right? The car and so on. You know, you could get in there and you knew how it worked. And these days, very few of us understand, you know, very much about the technologies that we use today at all. So one of the things that I think if we are going to create a human future, I talked at the beginning, I tried to emphasize that the creation of the future depends on what we are doing now. And if we want to create a human future or post-human future, that forget human, sentient future, aliens are welcome as well. We didn't even get onto aliens, right? There's a whole other sphere there. But a future that is that for sentient beings, then we have to be involved and we have to participate in that future. Right? So it's up to us to work with that. And we don't know what that will be. The only certainty is that we don't know what's going to be happening. Right? That's the only thing we know for sure. So we open up and you create all of these expectations so that the future that Stellark is showing us, or that Neil is showing us, or possibilities that are being opened up are different from the ones that maybe Google or Apple or Microsoft want to show us, right? They're showing us one vision of a future. There are others. One of my aims that I would like to see coming out of this session would be that the people here in the audience would be going home and thinking, okay, I'm going to get back and I'm going to take the back off my computer or off my mobile phone. I'll see if I can stick it in my ear or do something like that. We can take control of our own technology and take control of the future that we're going to create.
Thank you. That's the next question.
Hi, my name is Shane. I'm from Fremantle. Just first, I'd like to say thank you for expanding my mind. I was really struck by the challenge of trying to find how to connect Buddhism with what you're saying, but I managed to succeed in some ways, I think. Perhaps with Neil, you know, I thought of questions of the senses and contact and dependent origination and the nature of craving. And I might ask you a question now. With Stellark, I thought, you know, maybe you're investigating the nature of suffering and the path to overcoming suffering, you know. It looked like you certainly had overcome some of it with those hooks in your back. And then, you know, there's questions like, you know, with this AI coming along Dennis, you know, you mentioned at the end that it's not necessarily the technology that is going to be the problem, but it's the people controlling the technology. So one of my questions is, with the technology that we're exploring and gaining, can we use this in a way to develop compassion in those that are controlling technology? So is there a way we can use this technology to resolve the conflicts of potential conflicts of the future? I don't know if that's too open.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Maybe we'll let them have a think and we'll second question go along as well.
Thinking required.
Okay. No thinking required.
But that's a very good question, and it's something which is something I've been watching particularly in the tech sphere recently. And imagine a future, right? Imagine a future where your computer could read your mind, read your brain, and tell you whether you're feeling angry and you're feeling greedy or whether you're feeling compassionate and so on. And it can give you meditation instructions that is going to guide you towards that, okay? This is a contestable future, right? Except, of course, it's not a contestable future. It's a reality in the present, okay? You can download the app. Actually, one of the Australian Buddhist women, Tan Le, who runs a company called Emotive, we tried to get her for the conference, but she wasn't available. And they sell brain interface devices, and they have that. They have meditation apps. And so you're actually directly interfacing. The computer is telling you how to meditate, right? So this is the integration of Buddhist meditation with the technology that's being developed in various places all around the world is very, very intimate. I mentioned before about how Star Wars was an inspiring influence, and the Jedi Knights are part of that. It's not just me, right? I mean, there's the whole of Silicon Valley, right? They're all science fiction geeks. And the people in Google, they build a meditation hall, walking meditation hall. They have meditation classes all the time, the Look Within Yourself program and so on, Search Within Yourself program. So there's definitely, at a very deep level, meditation is becoming involved in these processes. Right? That's not unproblematic. In some ways, the involvement of meditation at a corporate level is, in fact, deeply problematic, because what's happening is that, you maybe get people who are stressed out, overworked, somebody burdened with the stress, not just burdened with too much work, but burdened with doing work that hurts people, right? And then, what do? Oh, you go to a mindfulness retreat and you learn to de-stress so you can come back and work even harder and do work that harms even more people, right? And this is sometimes what can happen. But I think that there is at least an opening and a way that in the future that we can by raising this and by putting this as an issue, that this should be a central consideration in the development of all our technology, and that is putting compassion at the heart of developing our technologies.
But the other way of framing this, which is a bit more problematic, I guess, is to see technology not as potentially affirming, the human condition or enabling our human functions, but rather to accept the fact that technology is highly destabilizing. With every new technology, there's new information about the world, there are new images of the world. In other words, we have to constantly reconfigure our paradigms of the world. I think a little anxiety, I think a little uncertainty, I think a lot of ambivalence goes a long way. It's not just about affirmation and being content with life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Richard.
My name is Richard. I'm from Perth. I think as a point of information, Stellark's work actually was of interest at one stage some time ago to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California, wasn't it? So there's a direct answer to your question. My question actually is for Neil, and the session just before lunch, we had P.L. Valpola talk about the Buddhist theory based on Buddhist principles about anxiety and depression, and he started with the senses. And the third speaker spoke about the interaction with nature and how beneficial that could be for us. In your talk, you mentioned that the senses had been, your senses have been extended very considerably in terms of infrared and ultraviolet. And I wondered if this had had any effect on your senses in terms of sense of nature and connectedness with nature, and also how that might affect your compassion for the natural world.
Yeah, it has completely. So now I feel a close relationship with bees because we both sense ultraviolet, and with many other animals that also sense infrared. So I can sometimes understand them better if they're looking at something. I know that they're looking at infrared or ultraviolet, so I can understand other animal species in a greater way. Also, I feel a deeper connection to dolphins because they also hear through bone conduction, which is the same system. Actually, I feel closer to hippopotamus because they hear through air conduction and bone conduction, so I can share a sense with them that I didn't before. And I believe that all the senses that we're developing are actually giving us a closer relationship, a closer relationship with other animal species, like feeling earthquakes. There's many other animals that can sense earthquakes in a greater way than us. Also sensing where the north is something that sharks can sense, also pigeons can sense, and the internal light is something also that some fish can have in total darkness. So the tooth is something that is not only practical, but it's also something that other animal species do. So becoming cyborgs can actually give us a better understanding of nature, because then you can suddenly rediscover nature through a new sense, and also it can actually allow us to connect to other animal species and to space, because internet connection can allow you to send your senses to space so that you can connect to other to satellites or cameras and then feel what you would feel if you were there. So instead of traveling to space, we can actually send our senses to space and feel that we are there. So it's a new way of exploring our context and our world and our galaxy.
Thank you, Neil. Before the next question, Neil, how many of you have this antenna?
No, just me.
Oh, just you. Okay. Right. So you sign up for being the second one, any one of you. Yeah. Could we have the question for Murphy?
Hi, I have a question of speed. Between the wheel and the, you know, rockets going into outer space, there's a few thousand years. Between two university teachers trying to communicate faster in between buildings, and the internet as we know it now, there's like 30, 40 years. Everything that we've seen here is mind-bubbling in a good way, and a first approach not as pleasant. But it can go very, very fast. So what can we do as the science speeds up to teach our new generation, like the ones that are very small and the one in high school, to be still and to be mindful in order for those discoveries here not to become the end of the world, not as we know it, but in a negative way, and to make things better so that they are artists, but they are scientists, they are businessmen in the not-so-good way that can use that in a wrong way.
Any particular speaker you'd like to direct your question to?
Not really. Maybe okay. The Buddhist. Because what can Buddhism do in order for, you know, for the new generation to learn about mindfulness in a way broader way than into the Buddhist temples?
Okay. So because we have a very limited time, we're going to be exceeding our time. So Guy, would you like to take that?
Do
you
want to? Just a quick answer before we go
okay.
to the Buddhist. what I do is art. This is what I do. And this is why I do. And this is why I conduct my research. You're right. It is scary. And you're right. This technology has a dark side. And